good afternoon. Welcome to the Space Show.
Thank you very much, Andrew.
You work for a company which is very much involved in space. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about the establishment of the company and what its activities are.
Well, the company is AusSpace, which in a sense sums it up, Australian Space. And we were originally a spin-off from the Australian National University, so the word Australia crops up everywhere. We were formed in 1982 as a result of the interest at the Australian National University in space instrumentation, and at the same time the interest by Marconi in the potential for involvement in the AusSat program. And a group of engineers was set up at Mount Stromlo to work on photon counting detectors to be applied to spacecraft, because the detectors developed at Mount Stromlo had a technological edge over any in the world at the time, and were well suited to space use.
So photons are particles of light?
That's right, and these detectors can count particle by particle, which is quite a feat. It's a very, very small amount of energy per photon. It's been described as the amount of energy that an amoeba gets when it throws itself off the edge of a piece of paper.
Amazing. Because I know that when people are looking in ordinary light, there are literally billions of photons or billions of particles of light entering your eye at one time, and you can count these one at a time.
That's right. Your eye can count down to about 100 photons in a packet under very good conditions, but we can count each photon as it comes in. And in our ultraviolet detectors, we can count roughly 8 out of 10 that come in, so it's both sensitive and accurate.
So ultraviolet light, of course, is the light that causes tanning of the skin and skin cancer. In space, presumably there's a lot more ultraviolet light, because we hear about the ozone layer protecting us. So you're taking this payload. What's the payload called?
The payload we're going to fly is called Endeavour, and it was a proof of concept payload for a program called Starlab, which was the original program that the ANU detectors were aimed at. You're right, there's the ultraviolet stops at the edge of the atmosphere, fortunately, but the interesting thing for the astronomers about the ultraviolet is that it's where all the exciting high energy things are happening, the ultraviolet and the X-ray. So that's why the space telescope has an ultraviolet capability, and why NASA has just launched the AXAF facility to look at these high energy events where black holes are pulling stars apart and so on.
So you get the instrument above the ozone layer, above the atmosphere, and your detector then picks up those rays that don't reach the Earth.
That's right.
And where do these rays come from? We've mentioned black holes. They come from the sun, of course.
They come from hot objects, essentially, either hot or otherwise energetic objects. Young hot stars, exploding galaxies, collapsing objects.
When did you make the package? I know there's been a problem getting it into space. Could you tell us a little about that, please?
Yes, the history of the Endeavour program is that the Australians were involved in this Starlab program, which was a collaborative effort between NASA, Canada and Australia, and part of the Australian role was to provide the detectors, which are really the heart of these instruments. But naturally, the international community said, this is a good idea, but will it work? We need to see it work before we can actually commit to a fully-fledged hundreds of millions of dollar program. So the Endeavour project was proposed as a proof of concept flight. That occurred in about 1984, and between 1984 and 1988 the payload was designed, built and tested, ready for flight. It was to have been a bicentennial project, so 1988 was the year that it was due to fly. It was finished in time for flight in 1988, but of course the shuttle problems meant that there was a considerable delay, and so as of today the payload is still waiting for a flight, which we think will be early in 1992 at this stage. And so since 1988 it's been sitting, waiting in the clean room up at Mount Stromlo Observatory, protected in dry nitrogen. And
Why do you do that? Why do you put it into nitrogen?
The telescopes in this are high-performance, innovative telescopes with what are called multi-layer optical coatings on them. They're a bit like the coatings on camera lenses or your glasses, but instead of suppressing reflections, they're designed to enhance reflections in the ultraviolet, and they allow very high throughput in a defined narrow wave band so that we can look at specific lines due to nitrogen, carbon and oxygen. but they're delicate. They're formed by evaporation of multiple layers of exotic materials. If they're exposed to too much wet atmosphere and water vapour, they'll degrade over time, the efficiency drops.
And you'd certainly get a lot of that on the top of Mount Stromlo.
That's right, yes, we get some quite humid days there.
Right. And my last understanding of the manifestation of this was that it was going to fly on the Endeavour, the first flight of the Endeavour. Is that still the case?
I'm not sure exactly when it's flying at the moment. That is certainly a possibility, and it would be quite a nice coincidence, but we're still discussing, because the problem is a lot of shuttle flights don't meet astronomical requirements. Often either the shuttle goes into what's called rotisserie mode to keep it uniformly warm, or into Earth-facing mode, and neither of those is really suited to astronomy. We need to wait for a mission that's looking into deep space.
Yes, perhaps we should point out to our listeners that we're talking here about an Australian payload called the Endeavour, and we have, quite separately from this, a space shuttle which has just been called Endeavour. That's the one built to replace the Challenger, and there's a chance that this Australian Endeavour may fly on the American shuttle, the Endeavour. A coincidence of naming. Okay, so after building this payload, this astronomical telescope, your company has moved on, and you're involved in some other instrumentation now.
Yes, I guess the history of the activities was that the original Starlab program ended when the Canadians pulled out because of funding problems. At that stage, the interest in our detectors was such that the Europeans approached Australia and said, well, we'd like a share of the action, if you like. Would you like to join us on a program called Lyman? And so subsequent to the Starlab work, we worked on the Lyman program. We developed the first open-windowed ultraviolet photon-counting detector for that program. Unfortunately, as is the case, 9 space programs out of 10 are cancelled or canned because of competitive reasons or funding. Lyman was one of them in the European context. Since then, we've moved on to, instead of looking out to space, looking down towards the ground. And one of the reasons for that is that while looking out to space is intellectually challenging and exciting, looking down to the ground provides a dollar today, if you like. You can see how well your crops are growing, or whether you are threatened by storm damage, so it's much more immediately useful information.
So it earns money, yes, against astronomy, which spends money.
Yes, obviously there are philosophical issues there as to what the role of research ought to be. But as a result, AusSpace has been involved with several programs funded by the Australian Space Office. One of these was called the Atmospheric Pressure Sounder, and that's an invention from the CSIRO. And we were involved in the development of a prototype which flies on the CSIRO research aircraft. It's a very nice idea for being able to measure the pressure on the ground from a satellite in space in vacuum, which is quite a challenging idea. At present, that program is, we think, about to go into Phase A, and we hope to be involved there. The beauty of that program is that you can measure with high accuracy the air pressure at the ground, which is a vital input to long-range weather forecasting. And in the southern hemisphere, because we've got a lot of oceans, not very much land mass, and there aren't very many ships around, we don't know much about what the air pressure is on a daily basis in the areas of the ocean where our weather forms, and this payload would be able to provide that.
So our weather, in fact, if you look at the weather map, you'll see it sweeping up from across the bight of Australia, off the Southern Ocean, and wham, into Victoria.
That's right.
So obviously, if we could get this instrument, then we'd have a better idea of our weather.
Yes, it's a good example of an instrument which is state-of-the-art. We would be able to provide information to the world's meteorologists, which nobody else can, and which allows us then to say, well, here's the information we're providing, therefore we'll take the information that you're providing. The concern is that in the longer term, although at present we get weather satellite data from the polar orbiting and geostationary satellites for free, in the next generation of satellites, it may be user pays. So that if we can't provide data in exchange, we'll have to provide money to get our weather satellite data that we see at the 7 o'clock news. APS will help overcome that.
And that money, if we did pay it, would go overseas, wouldn't it?
That's right.
Whereas if we
put the money into this instrumentation, the money stays here in Australia, by and large.
Not only does the money stay here, but the skill space is increased, which leads to very useful spin-offs. In addition, the national prestige, if you like, has increased. The Australian profile as a technologically capable and smart country has increased. And as the capability is increased, we get the capability to do other space programs. We're looking at some of those at present. One which we are in fact doing right now is another remote sensing payload called the Along Track Scanning Radiometer. This again is a program funded by the Australian Space Office. They're providing to the Rutherford Appleton Laboratory, which is part of the UK Science and Engineering Research Council, the infrared focal plane for an instrument which measures the temperature of the sea surface. And our company Ospace is actually doing the building of that, and we've done some of the design work. The history there is that an instrument has been built by the UK. It's flying on what's called ERS-1, which is due to be launched in May. Australia was in fact involved in ERS-1, again through Space Office funding. The importance of this instrument is that it looks at the temperature of the sea. The sea is a massive store of solar energy. The interchange of energy between the sea and the atmosphere is the thing that drives the so much of the weather. It absorbs and releases heat that drives the winds and so on. You can measure the sea temperature with a thermometer, but that isn't the same as the sea surface temperature, which is the temperature for the top 100 microns of the water. And that's the thing, the temperature there is the thing that determines the rate of evaporation and the rate of energy interchange.
So 100 microns is 0.1 of a millimetre.
It's about the thickness of a thick human hair, I guess, so it's not very much.
The thickness of a hair. And that thickness of water controls the weather.
Yes, it controls the rate at which the energy goes into or out of the bulk of the water. And when you think of the energy interchange, it's heat and it's water vapour which carries with it the latent heat of evaporation. And when you look at a thunderstorm, you can see just the dynamics of energy interchange as water condenses and evaporates. It's enormous.
And your satellite then can measure that thickness of the water, the temperature of it.
Yes.
And that surely then would be better than chucking a thermometer over the side of a ship.
Well, it's also a lot cheaper, it's a lot faster, and it's a lot more comprehensive, because these satellites typically orbit about 15 times a day, so you can get the temperature over 1 kilometre square pixels, and there are a lot of square kilometres over the Earth's surface. It also provides it to very high accuracy. I think from memory it's an absolute accuracy of 0.5 of a degree centigrade, or a relative accuracy of about 0.2 of a degree.
So that means that you can actually measure the temperature to within half a degree, and relative to another piece of water to within to a fifth of a degree.
That's right, and these relative differences are quite important for things like fishing. You can see where the hot water is upwelling and bringing nutrients with it. You can see the eddies running along the eastern coast of Australia. And it's only recently, when people have started looking at sea surface temperature measurements, that they've realised how much information is there for things like fisheries. And the orange roughy fishery in New Zealand is essentially an outgrowth of satellite sensing technology, because they looked at where the algae were, they looked at where the nutrients were, and decided to go and find out what was living there. Orange roughy, which is a very valuable export income for New Zealanders.
Well, who would have thought that satellites could help find the fish?
That's right.
Well, thanks for joining us today on the Space Show, Ed.
It's been a pleasure, Andrew.